It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech podcast brought to you by Fox News. Fox News has all of their podcasts at foxnewspodcasts.com. I hope that you will subscribe, rate, and review this one, and I thank you for all of those who have thus far. I appreciate also the engagement, the emails, and the conversation that came out of my last edition of the podcast with Vody Bakum, who certainly precipitated some interesting responses. Today I have a conversation with Mike Gonzalez. He is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He's at the Center for Foreign Policy there, and he's someone who has a very interesting background as a longtime journalist for the Wall Street Journal, in particular covering the global affairs of areas around the world, particularly Asia. But he's also someone who is himself Cuban and has taken a particular interest in what's been going on there in recent weeks, something that has certainly gathered the attention of a lot of different people who've been focused on Cuban politics for a while, seeing the upheaval in the streets, the crackdown that came in response to it, and really putting the Biden administration in a difficult position when it comes to navigating the politics of the moment as it relates to Cuba. I thought it would be a good time to talk to Mike about all of this. He's also, as it happens, someone who has been at the real point of impact on critical race theory in the country, particularly as you may have seen in the interactions that have happened in Loudoun County, Virginia, something that has attracted national attention, and where he's both spoken and given testimony on the various issues involved. Mike Gonzalez is a senior fellow at Heritage's Allison Center for Foreign Policy, and he spoke to us at length about Cuba, critical race theory, and other issues. Mike Gonzalez, right after this.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
Mike Gonzalez, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
It's a pleasure to be on with you, Ben. These are important matters.
They are indeed. Because you're someone who hasn't been on the program before, give our listeners a little bit of your own personal background, which is a pretty unique path to doing what you do now.
Well, I was a journalist for many, many years. I was a foreign correspondent. I covered the stock market for the Wall Street Journal, but I mostly lived, I did that. I wrote a column, but I also lived overseas for many years. I lived in Hong Kong for 8 years, 2 years in Korea, 6 years in Brussels. I covered pretty much Latin America, Europe, especially Europe and Asia, but some Latin America. Then after that, I joined the Bush administration as a speechwriter, and I've been here at Heritage for the last 12 years. I'm now a senior fellow, and I write a lot about Black Lives Matter and nationalism and critical race theory, especially lately, identity politics. Just with regards to the subject at hand, I was born in Cuba, left at the age of 12, and moved to Francisco Franco's Spain, where I lived for 2 years. So I have have the opportunity to say that I have lived under communism and fascism. Of course, if the fascism of Franco was a soft kind of fascism in the sense that they did not go after people because of their faith. I myself attended an evangelical Protestant school, but it was still a corporatist. Him and Salazar were the last two fascists in Europe. So I have seen that, and I have seen democracy, and I know which side I choose.
Mike, I know you have some unique perspective on the critical race theory conversation, and I do actually want to get to that with you as well, but we have to talk, as you made reference to, about the series of anti-government protests that have roiled the situation in Cuba and led to some initial responses from a number of different corners. Give us some perspective on what the different motivating factors are here. I think people generally have an idea of what's going on, but give them some perspective on the different driving elements that are leading to this type of upheaval that we're seeing.
Sure. And I'll tell you where how I think it started and where I think it's going to go. But just parenthetically, I don't know if you saw this overnight, Black Lives Matter, to the surprise of absolutely nobody who follows this, came out in very strong support of the communist government. I've been saying in interviews for the last 5 days that the only thing predictable about this is that this would happen. And indeed, it has happened. The squad will be next. Mm-hmm. So I think these are demonstrations that were sparked by the government's botched response to COVID-19. People are dying in greater numbers. The vaccines that the Cuban government came up with are absolute basura, trash. They don't work. The people know it. This is not a talking point of the left. I think conservatives are making a mistake in not understanding that, A, this is a fact. This is what sparked the protests. B, the protests were not then about vaccines or COVID. They morphed right away into pro-liberty protests because what it did is it's kind of it tapped into frustration with 62 years of economic mismanagement that you always get with socialism, but also of political repression of the brutal treatment of the government by the government of the people. So the government's brutal treatment of the people. So that came out right away. You hear the crowds chanting Libertad, Libertad. That means liberty. Obviously, it means freedom. One important point to note about this is that and there's no reason to run away from the fact that the protests were sparked by the government's bad response to COVID, is that the left has always, you know, crowed about how good Cuba's universal healthcare system is. Michael Moore and Sean Penn and everybody else on the squad. And they always talk about, well, this is what you get with socialism. You get stellar healthcare. No, it's trash. It's absolute trash. People are dying in Cuba, whereas we have solved this. I had a conversation with a journalist about a year ago, and she told me, I don't want to say who she was, but she's a very famous journalist in Cuba. And she said, look, totalitarian regimes are going to be better at handling the pandemic than liberal democracies. No, that's not the case. Totalitarian democracies, which suppress the freedom of information, which suppress the communications, are never going to be good at anything, at any human activity. Where is this going to go? Well, it's not going to go any place good for the Cubans, because the Castro family and the Communist Party is not interested in a peaceful transition to democracy and freedom. They're going to hang on to the very last dead Cuban if they have to. The only hope that this ends well for the Cubans, I'm sorry to say this, is for there to be dissension among the ranks. Now, just very quickly, Spain's ABC newspaper, which is usually reliable, reported on Wednesday that the vice minister of Interior, Jesus Manuel Burón, had resigned because of the government's brutal reaction, harsh reaction against the protesters, and that there was a lot of dissension among the ranks between the old guard and the new generals. The government in Cuba right away denied this was the case. They continue to deny it. The government in Cuba lies habitually, and ABC newspaper is usually reliable, but this is a developing story. Obviously, this is the only way, and you remember, Ben, that this is the way it happened in the Philippines in 86, mm-hmm. when Fidel Ramos said, I'm not going to shoot the protesters, turned against Marcos. If that happens in Cuba, then it could be over for the communists. But we continue to watch.
In the perspective of, I think, many Americans who don't pay as much attention typically to the Cuban political situation, the perspective that they have is mostly through the domestic lens of just knowing that there are a lot of engaged Cuban Americans who want to see a response from the American government that would help support those pushing for liberty and attempt to use opportunities as they stand to change the regime. That's something, though, that I think they lack a lot of perspective on in terms of how things have changed in the wake of a number of different aspects over the past several years. You saw a shift under President Trump away from the Obama-Biden agenda. Now people are hearing, this is going to provoke some kind of reconsideration on the Biden administration's part. What do you see so far? How has the Biden administration responded to this situation? And what is their rationale for what's going on in terms of the politics there that would lead them to perhaps make certain choices that could influence what the outcomes ultimately are?
So the Biden administration actually did not have Cuba. The administration has been very slow about everything and very wrong about everything. It insists in talking to China about climate change, of all things. It gets lectured at by China. And then we have the ambassador to the United Nations telling the world, that the ambassador who's there to defend us, telling the world that we're a bad country with systemic racism and that the ideals of the founding were wrong to start with. So all the Chinese ambassador has to do is pretty much copy and paste her remarks and just repeat them back to us. There were signs that the Biden administration was going to warm up against towards Castro the way the Obama administration did. You had Juan Gonzalez, who's the director of the National Security Council for Western Hemisphere Affairs, announcing on CNN Espanol about 4 weeks ago that the Biden administration was considering it was probably going to send the ambassador back to Havana, was going to lift the limits on the remittances, maybe reopen Western Union. First of all, one has to take issue with a senior government official announcing a policy change in Spanish only. That has to be remarked upon because it shuts out the rest of the population, all of the population, really, the majority. And we should conduct our business in English. So I think what has happened now is that this is going to at least hit the pause button on that because... And I think one of the reasons why Biden did not move on that right away was that he saw how the Cuban American population in Florida voted overwhelmingly for Trump. The unofficial numbers I have seen is 70-30. Cubans always vote conservative, but 70-30 was not reached even by Reagan or George W. Bush. But now this is the question is, obviously, the sanctions that President Trump put in place, especially the remittances part, has played a key role here. We cannot deny this. Does the Biden administration throw a lifeline to the puppet president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, who is president, but really the power continues to be the Castro family behind it? It is them who benefit economically. They're the head of GAESA, which is the kind of the economic entity that controls about 80% of the Cuban economy. He is Castro's former son-in-law, but still very close to Castro. Alejandro Castro Spín, Castro's son, remains in the background, very important politically. Does Biden throw these thugs a lifeline by reopening remittances again? And or worse, does he allow them to have a flotilla of refugees come in and allow the Castros once again to export their discontent to kind of take the pressure off on the island? Alejandro Mayorkas, you saw.
Yes.
Said, now we're going to intercept every Cuban. Cubans cannot take to the high seas. That obviously sets up a dichotomy, right? We have an open border, a crisis on the Mexican border that Biden created, that Biden Harris created. And then they're telling the Cubans, don't take to the high seas. But I think the stupid thing that Mayorkas did was that he addressed himself to the Cuban people rather than to the Cuban government. It should be a very strong warning to the Cuban government, do not do this. Do not set up a flotilla of people like you did in 1980 with Mariel or in 1994. Deal with your own people. Listen to their demands. They're asking you to step down and go away. Do not export your problems away.
You know, one of the things that is, I think, a concern for many in this moment is that the Biden administration seems to have priorities, as you made reference to, that are really not aligned with the most important aspects of political freedom around the world. They seem to be much more interested in pushing an agenda on climate or on just undoing in a knee-jerk fashion anything that the Trump administration achieved, that I think a lot of people are you know, skeptical about. And it's one of the reasons why the early days of this administration seem to have a lot of incoherence to them. When it comes to Cuba, do you believe that the Biden administration really wants to stand with those Cubans who are presenting a disruptive and pro-liberty message? Or would they rather this problem goes away so that they can get back to their international agenda of wokeness and of climate deals and the like?
You mean you're a very astute observer of the political scene here, Ben. You know that Biden was going nowhere about a year ago. Bernie Sanders had in spring of 2020, had all the energy in the party. All the energy is with that far, far left. And in fact, Bernie Sanders was, when he started praising the Castro government, when he started praising Fidel Castro, what he had done in Cuba, right away you saw the big honchos in the party stir. All of a sudden, on one Monday, Susan Rice and Samantha Power and Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar all come out and say, we're supporting Joe Biden. I have nothing to base myself on, but I believe Barack Obama was ringing people up and saying, Bernie Sanders is going to continue to talk like a Marxist and he might win. He's going to win the primary unless we stop him. Biden continues to be held hostage to this.
Yeah.
You know, he's very afraid when he waited a full day before he made a statement on Cuba. We had a statement. The Heritage Foundation had a statement on Cuba before the White House. All there was a tweet, a hapless tweet by Assistant Secretary Chung in Western Hemisphere at the State Department, which was laughable. And then Biden comes out with a statement Monday, very, very tepid, and does not mention that the nature of the government in Cuba is communist or Marxist, calls it authoritarian, as if we have lost the distinction between authoritarianism and totalitarianism. And it's to the surprise of nobody, Black Lives Matter comes out the night of Wednesday to Thursday this week with a very strong statement that is pro-government in Cuba. And I think that Biden is afraid of the squad. He's afraid of the Black Caucus, which unfortunately and sadly has for decades supported the Castro government under the misguided belief that it does something for Cuba's Black population. You know that is not the case. That is white supremacy. It's a government held in the hands of white people. The Castros are the children of a white a Spanish guy who went there at the turn of the century. Miguel Díaz-Canel is blue-eyed and white, whereas the majority of the Cuban population is either black or mixed race. But bafflingly, it shows that the ideology means more to the squad and the Black Caucus and BLM. They support the Castro government. I think Biden is like a deer in the headlights, caught it by the looking at this, and they could not have a very strong statement that is pro-democracy. This is just a low-hanging fruit, a moment to have a tear down this wall moment. If he has an inner Reagan, this is the moment to channel that inner Reagan and call the Cuban government an evil empire, but he will not do so. The only explanation that I have is what I've given you. He's afraid of the left in his own flank.
I found it to be pretty revealing when I was covering the 2020 primaries in South Carolina, that voter after voter at Democrat events who were supporting Biden would bring up the Castro comments from Sanders. We're just talking about, you know, a state that has a pretty heavy, you know, Navy and military population, has Democrats who are very traditionalist in terms of their attitude toward the flag and toward religion. And just, you know, I mean, voter after voter, black and white, would cite Sanders' support for Castro as being a non-starter. And to me, that was a very revealing element that didn't receive a lot of national coverage from the media, but was basically them saying, you know, hey, we're not down with this socialism crap. And to me, that's something that actually also predated and or presaged the kind of elements that led to the Trump performance in the fall among Hispanic voters who are particularly mindful of the threat of socialism. And as much as the media liked to pretend that that was in some way either a political dog whistle or that it was an irresponsible framing, they were doing so in opposition to everything that people actually heard from the squad and from the far left in so many respects when it came to the language of socialism. Why does that language have such enduring power on the left when political wisdom would indicate that that's not the way that they ought to go, whether it's that or defunding the police or any of these other extreme things that the far left has been pushing into the mainstream of the Democrat Party over the past several years?
Because Marxists are a cult. You know this. The ideology reigns supreme. We're going to have to be dealing with Marxism forever. It's never going to go away. Our children are going to have to deal with this. They you know, what Marx and Engels released in 1848 was you know, the Furies from Hades. This is, and they strongly believe in this to the point that it's quasi-religious. They don't believe their lying eyes that socialism is an utter failure everywhere. It's the only thing that's perfect at, is that it has failed everywhere. They're still at war with individual private property. They're still at war with working for wages, which, as you know, Marx called wage slavery. It was a continuation of slavery by other means. You just worked for another man and he paid you wages, but you still had to trade in your labor. This is all crazy stuff. And they're at war with the family. Why? Again, Marx, the manifesto, abolish the family. The family, as you know, is the basis of not just love, but of society, of community. But, you know, Marx and Engels say abolish the family in the manifesto. And in their own manifesto, Black Lives Matter had a very strong anti-family statement that they only staked down when they scrubbed their website in September 2020 after I and others write about this and point out how Marxist they are. By the way, I don't know if you know this, but my next book coming out in September, already in pre-sale on Amazon, is on BLM. And the title is BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. So I don't know how they can hide the fact that they're Marxist. They say they're Marxist. BLM has a foreign policy. It is pro-Castro and pro-Hamas.
We'll have more with my conversation with Mike Gonzalez right after this. You know, I view this whole thing as being an interesting early test case for the Biden administration and for what the Democratic Party represents when it comes to their foreign policy for the future. We all saw what happened in Alaska when the Chinese representatives started quoting the far left's agenda and perspective on America back at the representatives of the Biden administration, who seemed woefully unprepared to defend America, having, you know, spent the previous several years during their push to get rid of Donald Trump, you know, running it down and saying all these terrible things about it. In terms of their performance there, I think a lot of people were embarrassed, but I also thought that they were caught by surprise. And so to a certain extent, I thought, well, you know, let's give them another month or two and have them figure out the way that they're going to advocate for America without necessarily critiquing those who are their political allies. This test case in this moment doesn't seem to be giving us any opportunity to see that they've gotten any better at it. And it seems to me that that's because they have accepted essentially the BLM critical race theory and now in a politically transparent way, the Chinese posturing about the nature of America as being this fundamentally immoral actor on the world stage. Do you expect that to change at all? Because it doesn't seem to me to be sustainable. And the other thing about it is, it doesn't seem to be consistent with, and I grant you, he's not a very consistent politician, but it hasn't been consistent with the approach that Joe Biden has used in the past. You know, even when he was in office for so many years in the Senate and active in the Foreign Relations Committee.
I'm with you. I was chagrined to see Blinken just have his you know what handed back to him by the Chinese foreign minister in Alaska. It was just pathetic. They seem to be baffled by the simplest of tasks. They are flummoxed. And as I said, all you need to do is go back to Ambassador Linda Thomas Greenfield and what she has said herself. This is our ambassador. Governments nominate ambassadors to defend their country, not to do what Ambassador Thomas Greenfield has done, which is to say that our founding was implicated in racism. Our very founding ideals she has spoken out against. I mean, she has made the job of the Iranian ambassador and the Chinese ambassador and the Russian ambassador and the Cuban ambassador very, very, very easy. As I said, all they need to do is cut and paste. And if we say, no, we're not like that, we're a good country. We've made mistakes, obviously. We've made many mistakes. We're good people. We're a good country. They can just say, no, well, actually, I'm quoting your own ambassador. Going forward, I would like to think that they would recalibrate and say, you know, the old quote by Macmillan, what are you afraid of, Prime Minister? Events. They should learn that events are going to happen. And the only way you can be reactive to events in time is by having principles, by having ideals and then when an event happens, like the Cuban pro-democracy demonstration, you go back to your principles and say, what does my principle dictate? And then you come out with a statement right away because you're based on bedrock principles. No, their principles are that we're systemically racist. They base their foreign policy on the belief that we live in an oppressive social order. This is a bedrock principle of critical race theory, which you find this is not Kendi, this is not Robin DiAngelo, who are critical race theory trainers. No, I am quoting people like Derek Bell and Kimberly Crenshaw and Cheryl Harris or Angela Harris, the architects, Richard Delgado, the architects of critical race theory. They say that we live in an oppressive society, an oppressive social order under systemic racism. That racism is not an individual sin, but it is written into the law, and the law must be dismantled, and the system must be dismantled. When this is your North Star, you're in trouble. And I think this is why we see what we see with the Biden-Harris administration.
I want to shift to talking, as you've brought them up, about this surge of popularization of critical race theory that both, you know, exploded in the wake of the death of George Floyd and became essential parts of the human resources curricula for workers across America, and has also led to the discovery that not only is this something that has been creeping across in terms of expanded demands for teaching it within public schools, but in reality, I would say it's a discovery among parents that this same stuff that they began to run into in their workplaces was already being taught in various ways to their children at taxpayer expense in public schools. I know you've been someone who's paid a lot of attention to this and to the local county in Virginia, Loudoun County, which has received national attention for what's been going on there. What are the different dynamics at play there? And what do you think are the key elements that our listeners ought to know?
So, yeah, right. I've been to Loudoun County. By the way, when I travel across the country, and I have traveled already extensively the last 2 months, and I have a 9-city tour coming up in 4 weeks. People do bring up Loudoun County. Loudoun County is ground zero for critical race theory in the way that they began it. It's comparable to the committees of correspondence that began in the 1760s and 1764. They are organic, and also they are directed by Sam Adams in Boston, who establishes the first committee of correspondence. They have, and I think the parents at a meeting, they themselves are talking of the tension between the need for a national network and the need for this to remain a local issue in every place in all 14,000 school districts. They don't want to make the mistake that they see the Tea Party has having made. Look, as you know, I talk extensively about critical race theory and critical theory. I devoted a whole chapter to critical theory in my book, The Plot to Change America, published last July. It's been selling well because we have seen The Plot to Change America play out, and Encounter has plans. My publisher has plans to publish a paperback edition next year now. What happened, Ben, is this is a discipline that begins in the late 80s, begins really it gets its name, critical race theory, at a conference in a convent of all places outside of Madison, Wisconsin, in 1989. Then it becomes dominant very quickly in law schools across the country, becomes dominant in the academy, but it doesn't seep out, right? Its impact on public policy is limited. It begins to kind of enter schools about 3 or 4 years ago. We saw this in the New York City public school system, where they begin to have critical race theory curricula in trainings in 2018, but really remains contained, as you put it, until George Floyd, the tragic death, and the deft use of that video by Marxist organizations that go under the name of Black Lives Matter, and they destabilize the whole country. And all of a sudden, what I say is that two bad viruses jumped the lab in 2020, one COVID-19 and the other one CRT. CRT then begins to enter all aspects of our lives, the military, the houses of worship, schools, workplaces. And then it meets something that it hasn't met for 20 years. It meets resistance. But this time it's not resistance from other academics like Randall Kennedy at Harvard, who resisted critical race theory, but who was overwhelmed. This time it's resistance from the American people, who have, as you know, a unique and exceptional attachment to liberty. And the American people have not read Kimberlé Crenshaw, perhaps, but they know, it's like the old thing about pornography, they know when they see it, but they know this is ideological pornography, and they reject it. And this is where we are right now. I think, by the way, that conservatives for once, have begun very well in being able to frame this debate. This has the left panicked. Nicole Hannah-Jones and every host on MSNBC and CNN, Don Lemon, they're all reacting in panic, saying there's no CRT in schools. And yet in the next breath, they say, but we're going. This is actually the teachers' unions, the National Education Association, and AFT, the two largest teachers unions, they say both. They say, no, it's not being used in the curriculum in schools, but we're going to be spending millions of dollars making sure that it is taught in all 14,000 school districts. And the NEA names the Heritage Foundation, because they cannot say we're anti-parent. So they have to name a large organization like my organization and say, we're going to be spending thousands of dollars doing awful research on them. You know what? Let them do whatever they want.
I know that you, just as we're wrapping up here, are seeing the reaction among conservatives to this, and not just among conservatives in terms of politically engaged people, but right. just in terms of people who are traditionalist in right. their approach and in their view of the country. And I know that as you go across and speak across the country, I've had this experience too. You know, person after person will come up to you and say, you know, what do I do? How do I fight this? And I keep going back to the idea that, well, it's going to require you to stand up in your community and be engaged there. And to me, this is a very unhealthy and obviously very dangerous thing, critical race theory. But it also is leading to a healthy development, which is that I think for far too long, conservatives who claim to care a lot about localism were actually very locally disengaged. They had been led to focus far too much on the presidency and national politicians, on members of Congress and the like, which, while important, actually have far less to do, as we saw during the pandemic, with the way people live their day-to-day lives than state and local officials in terms of their determinations. What kind of advice do you give to people about how they can push back within their communities?
Well, first of all, I completely agree with you. Conservatives always bring a rhetorical knife to a gunfight. Mm-hmm. This time is different. This time, conservatives have gotten off the gate and done really well. I think that, and by the way, it's the American people that are doing this. And by the way, it's not just conservatives, too. I think you bring up a very good point. It's liberals like Steven Pinker and Andrew Sullivan and Barry Weiss. The group FAIR in New York is doing really, really, really well. And everybody in that group is a liberal on their board, almost everybody. These are liberals who like liberty. I don't agree with Steven Pinker at Harvard on almost everything, but I do like the fact that he likes liberty. I think parents need to, and I think, take a page of what the courageous Cubans have done, lose their fear. The Cubans are risking being thrown in dungeons with rats and feces. That's not going to happen here. You know, all we're risking is being canceled by social media. So I think people are beginning to push back against HR. People are beginning to push back against their school boards. The school boards are reacting like authoritarians do everywhere. They limit meetings. They try to have Zoom meetings so they don't have the scenes we saw in Loudoun County, where they had to shut down the comment period because they were getting comments they didn't like, and they didn't like the energy in the room. That was authoritarian. And I think push back, you know, call your principal, call your teacher. Say, why are you doing this? Why are you teaching my son this? Why are you teaching my daughter this? My daughter's not a racist. Why are you teaching my son that he cannot make it in America because he's black? That is false and that is disgusting. Why are you teaching my Spanish surname kid that punctuality is not for him? That is insulting and stupid and false. I think, and this is why this is colorblind. People from all walks of life in America standing up and saying, you're not doing this to me. You're not doing this to my family. People have, why? Because they love their children. They love their places of work and they love their country. And they know that what they're facing is really not about race. It's about power. It's about changing the country.
Mike Gonzalez, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you, Ben.
You know, in terms of unpacking the different things that have come out of the pandemic, I certainly think that there are some smart individuals who are starting to gain some appreciation at a remove for the level of fear-mongering that happened throughout this. Coming from journalists, of course, but also coming from people in government, people in academia, and really the ways that the science around this pandemic was used to further the cause of a lot of different leftists who want to see government have a much stronger role in controlling our lives. It's really something that is disturbing when you take a step back and look at what has gone on there. There's a very interesting piece that is in the latest edition of City Journal, brought to you by the Manhattan Institute, written by John Tierney. He's a contributing science columnist for the New York Times and co-author of The Power of Bad, How the Negativity Effect Rules Us and How We Can Rule It. He's an interesting writer and thinker, and he writes at length about the real disturbing aspects of what happened in terms of the coverage of what was going on during the pandemic. He writes in part, "The panic was started as usual by journalists. As the virus spread early last year, they highlighted the most alarming statistics and the scariest images. the estimates of a fatality rate 10 to 50 times higher than the flu, the chaotic scenes at hospitals in Italy and New York City, the predictions that national healthcare systems were about to collapse. The full-scale panic was set off by the release in March 2020 of a computer model at the Imperial College in London, which projected that, unless drastic measures were taken, intensive care units would have 30 COVID patients for every available bed, and that America would see 2.2 million deaths by the end of the summer. The British researchers announced that the only viable strategy was to impose draconian restrictions on businesses, schools, and social gatherings until a vaccine arrived. This extraordinary project was swiftly declared the consensus among public health officials, politicians, journalists, and academics. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, endorsed it and became the unassailable authority for those purporting to follow the science. What had originally been a limited lockdown, 15 days to slow the spread, became long-term policy across much of the United States and the world. A few scientists and public health experts objected, noting that an extended lockdown was a novel strategy of unknown effectiveness and that had been rejected in previous plans for a pandemic. It was a dangerous experiment being conducted without knowing the answer to the most basic question, just how lethal is this virus? The most prominent early critic was John Ioannidis, an epidemiologist at Stanford who published an essay for Stat headlined "A Fiasco in the Making: As the Coronavirus Pandemic Takes Hold, We Are Making Decisions Without Reliable Data." While a short-term lockdown made sense, he argued, an extended lockdown could prove worse than the disease, and scientists needed to do more intensive testing to determine the risk. The article offered common sense advice from one of the world's most frequently cited authorities on the credibility of medical research, but it provoked a furious backlash on Twitter from scientists and journalists. The fury intensified in April 2020 when Ioannidis followed his own advice by joining with Jay Bhattacharya and other colleagues from Stanford to gauge the spread of COVID in the surrounding area, Santa Clara County. After testing for COVID antibodies in the blood of several thousand volunteers, they estimated that the fatality rate among the infected in the country was about 0.2%, twice as high as for the flu, but considerably lower than the assumptions of public health officials and computer modelers. The researchers acknowledged that the fatality rate could be substantially higher in other places where the virus spread extensively in nursing homes, which hadn't yet occurred in the Santa Clara area, but merely by reporting data that didn't fit the official panic narrative, they became targets. Other scientists lambasted the researchers and claimed that methodological weaknesses in the study made the results meaningless. A statistician at Columbia wrote that the researchers owe us all an apology. A biologist at the University of North Carolina said that the study was horrible science. A Rutgers chemist called Ioannidis a mediocrity who cannot even formulate a simulacrum of a coherent rational argument. A year later, Ioannidis still marvels at the attacks on the study, which was eventually published in a leading epidemiology journal. Scientists whom I respect started acting like warriors who had to subvert the enemy, he says. Every paper I've written has errors. I'm a scientist, not the Pope. But the main conclusions of this one were correct and have withstood the criticism. Mainstream journalists piled on with hit pieces quoting critics and accusing the researchers of endangering lives by questioning lockdowns. The Nation called the research a black mark for Stanford. The cheapest shots came from BuzzFeed, which devoted thousands of words to a series of trivial objections and baseless accusations. The article that got the most attention was BuzzFeed's breathless revelation that an airline executive opposed to lockdowns had contributed $5,000, yes, $5,000, to an anonymized fund at Stanford that had helped finance the Santa Clara fieldwork. The notion that a team of prominent academics who were not paid for their work in the study would risk their reputations by skewing results for the sake of a $5,000 donation was absurd on its face, and even more ludicrous given that Ioannidis, Bhattacharya, and the lead investigator, Aaron Ben-David, said they weren't even aware of the donation while conducting the study. But Stanford University was so cowed by the online uproar that it subjected the researchers to a two-month fact-finding inquiry by an outside legal firm. The inquiry found no evidence of conflict of interest, but the smear campaign succeeded in sending a clear message to scientists everywhere: don't question the lockdown narrative. I encourage you all to read this piece by John Tierney in City Journal. You can find it at city-journal.org. It's called "The Panic Pandemic," and it certainly is something that I think should receive a high level of attention, given the kind of things that all of these experts, so-called experts, within media and within government fields would very much like to have this story swept under the rug. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
from the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.